Welcome to the City Club of Eugene. Can I have your attention, please? It's just afternoon on Friday the 13th here at the Downtown Athletic Club, and Monday the 16th at 6:30 for our KLCC listeners. I'm Jerry Diethelm, filling in for Club President Rick Dancer, who is away on KEZI business. Our speaker today is Dr. Greg Botham, Professor of Physics at the U of O, who will be exploring the question, alternatives to gasoline, can they meet our demand? And there are some visuals and things that for the listening audience, if they go to the City Club website, you'll see that they will appear there, and you'll be able to review some of the things that you're hearing visually. Our first questioner will be Bill Tracy, a club member and retired executive from Saudi Aramco. And speaking of oil, it reminds me of my favorite Golda Meir story. When she was prime minister of Israel back in the early 70s, you know, she said, Moses, she said, for 40 years he wandered in the wilderness and then settled in the only place without oil. So now let's pause for a moment to welcome new members and guests and to thank our sponsors. We have student guests today from O'Hara Catholic School, Network Charter School, and Jefferson Middle School. If you'd all please stand. New members and guests, are any in the audience? All right. And a special thanks this week to this week's sponsors, Goodwill Industries, Summit Bank, Wine Styles, Liberty Bank, and to the anonymous donor that is generously sponsoring our student program. You know who you are, and good for you. Now, since I'm filling in all around today, let me introduce our speaker. Today's speaker's research interests reach all the way from the stars to sustainable energy right here on Earth. An astrophysicist, he is presently the director of the U of O's Pine Mountain Observatory, where he specializes in observational astrophysics and cosmology. He came to Oregon in 1990, just 3 years after SN 1987A. I'll let him explain that. His down-to-earth interests include climate change and other matters related to environmental sustainability. He's a key figure in the U of O's Environmental Studies program and has been instrumental in developing the campus-wide use of the internet, computer technology, and classroom instruction, and distant learning. And here's the fact of the day. Did you know that there are only 6,000 astrophysicists in the world? Now, assuming 6 billion people, you put this up on your mental blackboard. That's what my mother always said. Put this up. 6 billion people divided by 6,000 astrophysicists, and that would make him literally, but only partly explain his reputation as one in a million. In this morning's paper, we read about Chevron and Weyerhaeuser joining forces to produce cellulosic-based biofuel. Can alternative fuel sources ease our ever-increasing demand for gas, Professor? And is this even the right question? Please welcome Greg Botham.
Thank you. One in a million just means you're really strange. So just bear with me. The Earth is not infinite, newsflash. A lot of people pretend that it is. And in view of the fact that the Earth is not infinite, means we're going to run out of stuff, everything, eventually. Oil seems to be close to being run out, given the rapid increase in worldwide consumption, which I'll go through momentarily. So we need some form of alternative fuel, alternative transport. Lots of possibilities are out there. What are the capabilities of these possibilities? To start off with, it's really important to understand the scale of the problem. I'll give you some basic factoids to remember. The first one, 400 million gallons of gas a day, 400 million today. Average cost of $2.50, next, That means that every day, just remember this, when you're at the gas pump, that day $1 billion other dollars, are being spent on this commodity, and most of that money being exported to foreign governments. If that strikes anybody in this room as insane, it is. $1 billion a day. Keep that as a figure of merit when we talk about investments later. Total vehicle miles go up 2 to 3% per year, independent of the price of gas. Every 25 years, we double our vehicle miles, and we remain fixed in this average fuel economy of 20 to 25 miles per gallon, which means each American spends $1,000 to $2,000 a year on this habit, and everybody's aware of this. So the question is, can we do better? And now we're no longer the major problem. We have a new player in the game, next, which is the rapid rate of the emergence of the Chinese economy, which is a major energy footprint on the planet that will dwarf the last 150 years of the Industrial Revolution in both the Europe and US. The rate at which the Chinese vehicle fleet is growing, it's doubling every 3 years. Every 3 years, there's twice as many cars on the road using gasoline in China than there was previously. This is has a major, major impact on where the worldwide supply of oil goes. Next. Now, we've all heard about this idea of peak oil. It's an oversimplification of the supply and demand curve. Next. You see something that looks like this, known conventional resources as a function of location on the Earth, when it's going to be pumped out. You see a curve, it's kind of got a peak, kind of around now. Does that mean we're going to fall off a precipice? And the answer is no. Next. Because this is the real world. The real world refines 84 million barrels a day of crude oil. That's all it can refine. We've saturated our worldwide refining infrastructure and have been at that point for the last 18 months. Now, you can go and extract more oil. You can extract 120 million barrels a day if you want, but you can't do anything with it. And this is where we're going to be stuck at. It's probably a good thing we're going to be stuck at here. I don't think anybody wants to increase the refining capacity of the planet. But when you have this kind of finite distribution limit of 84 million barrels a day, next, you produce a curve that's got a plateau in it. And that's where I think we're going to be for the next 10 years. Over the next 10 years, every single day, we're going to use 84 million barrels a day. We're not going to use more, and we're not going to use less. And then we're going to have a relatively rapid fall off. So the really interesting time is about 10 years from now. Next. Now, this is a busy slide. I'll go through it fast, but it's the heart of the matter. Just click twice now. We have stuff that we want to turn into fuel to stick in our car. Okay, go ahead. We have crude oil as our number one feedstock, and we can make gasoline and diesel out of that. And that's our normal pathway. Crude oil in the ground, dead dinosaurs die, we pump it out, stick it in the atmosphere, all on a timescale of 150 years. That's the human impact. We change natural timescales. We compress natural events in a very short periods of time. The system, the Earth system, can't absorb that impact in that amount of time, so it's perturbed. Now, we have this alternative involving biomass, go ahead, that eventually turns into ethanol, which I'll spend the bulk of my remarks on in a while. But we don't have to just have this one dichotomy of gasoline or ethanol. There's something else that's in an intermediate stage that's very valuable. And its feedstocks are natural gas, coal, nuclear, petroleum, biomass, and other renewables like wind and solar or wave energy or tidal energy or ocean thermal electric conversion, whatever alternative renewable that you want to use. Go ahead. And those things can produce other forms of alternative fuels which are as viable, if not more viable, than ethanol, liquid petroleum gas, compressed natural gas, and more importantly, either liquid or gaseous hydrogen. There are various pathways that connect the feedstocks to the fuels, but the most important one is that everything in that intermediate area of fuel of feedstock can be used to make electricity. Once you make electricity, you can then make hydrogen. A very viable project is to populate the Aleutian Wind Island chain with wind turbines. It's the windiest place on the planet. Forget about connecting it to the grid. That would be way too expensive. Use hydrogen as a proxy for the grid. Make hydrogen in situ and transport it. Get 150 million fuel cells populated that way easily with an Aleutian Island wind farm. So this is the other possible pathway, is using electricity generated mostly by stranded renewables and not by those other sources, to produce hydrogen. So we have hydrogen, we have ethanol. What's the total yield? What's the capacity? Can we really do business this way? What's the bottom line, so to speak? Well, first I remind you of what our consumption is in round numbers, 200 billion gallons a year of gasoline, 200 billion gallons, okay? Now, we all know about biodiesel, the concept of using the waste oil from McDonald's restaurants to power our vehicles. And the question is, what kind of penetration can you get? What's the physics? And it's like this. You need 7.3 pounds of soybean material to make a gallon of biodiesel. So then you ask, what's the maximum amount of soybeans you can grow and harvest in a year to get your maximum yield? And that's the answer. 2 billion gallons. Well, that sounds like a lot. If you go to your neighbor and said, you know, we can get 2 billion gallons a year from biodiesel, your neighbor will think, well, why are we using gasoline? Why aren't we using biodiesel? I mean, 2 billion gallons is infinite, right? No, it's 1% of consumption. And this is the part of the scale problem that is never mentioned properly in the media or in the policy debate, but it's the physics of the problem. How much can you get from resource X? Because in the end, that's what matters. So biodiesel is 1% penetration. So the question is, can ethanol production do better than biodiesel? Now, ethanol comes from two sources. Most of you are used to the idea that you grow some corn primarily and you get some grain. And you can make grain alcohol if you want. You can put that in your car too, that works just fine. Or anywhere else you need to put it. Or you can make ethanol. And if you think about that, you go, well, let's see, corn. Corn's got this big stalk with this stuff on it. It's about 4 feet high or 6 feet high in the Willamette Valley, and it's got a little ear of corn on it. And I'm going to take these grains of corn, and I'm going to throw the rest of the plant away. That's not very efficient. Isn't there a way that I can use the rest of the plant? Can I put the rest of my plant in my gas tank? That would make more sense. And that's called cellulosic ethanol, which is basically using the rest of the plant instead of just the grain. And as you'll see, grain-produced ethanol is not scalable at all. It's not a solution. But cellulosic ethanol actually has an incredible amount of promise. All right. There has been a scholarly debate for 20 years, which I would say has been resolved over the last 3 to 4 years, which is, but people live in the past a lot, and so people's past impression of a situation usually stays with them in the wake of more recent data that overturns your past impression. Kind of explains why the Earth was in the center of the solar system for so long. Same problem. And the concept is, doesn't it take more energy to grow the crops than it does that you actually get out of them? And if you did that research in the 80s and early 90s, the answer was yes. It took more energy to grow the crops than you would get out of them, so that would be stupid to do this because it's a net energy sink. All of that has changed now considerably in a way I'll describe momentarily. But here's some sort of quantitative numbers to scale the problem. If I ask, how much fossil energy input do I have to put into something to get the same energy output? The answer is, for ethanol, I have to put in 0.74 units now. In the past, I would have had to put in 1.5 units, but not anymore, just 0.74 now. For gasoline, I have to put in about 1.25 or whatever it says up there. That's a big difference. And for the electricity that we generate, we have to put in 2.33 units, which makes electricity the number one vehicle that we use to transport carbon from the ground to the atmosphere. So ethanol now wins significantly with respect to initial fossil energy input required to give the same unit energy output compared to gasoline. This is a relatively recent change. As a result, this net energy ratio, which is energy out compared to energy in, is now about 1.5 for ethanol. That's good. It's more than 1, which is real good, and 1.5 begins to make it feasible and scalable. Why has this happened? It's because of significant improvements in crops per unit acre efficiency. You can see it was relatively flat from 1965 up till the early 90s, and then improved technology, improved breeding practices, improved farming practices have led to a very significant increase in crop efficiency by 50% over the last 15 years. And it's that 50% increase in crop efficiency which has turned into this net energy ratio of 1.5, which now makes ethanol or crop-produced fuels a significant net energy gain. The energy that you get out in your fuel tank from growing a crop is significant. And that's what's different than in 1990. And people who still live in 1990 are running around saying ethanol is a net energy sink because they haven't paid any attention to what's going on. Now, it's likely that we've saturated and we're flat now. Maybe we can improve through something called precision farming, which I don't really want to talk about because it's boring, beyond that. But it's that leap from 0.4 to 0.6 in those units of bushels per pound of fertilizer, which is very, very significant, and which we can now leverage to say, well, how many cars can we drive now on this kind of stuff because of this increase? All right, so now we can do a new yield calculation and get to, you know, where we want to get to. Is this feasible? It takes about 10 kilograms of corn to produce enough grain to produce a gallon of gas, gallon of ethanol. On an ideal acre, you get 850 gallons per acre. Remember, we need 200 billion gallons every year, not just 850, 200 billion. Now, all acres are not ideal. They're not all the same. In the real world, a practical acre, a practical crop yield, is about two-thirds of this ideal acre. So you do a little bit of arithmetic, and you require 350 million acres of cropland required to produce enough grain-based ethanol to satisfy our consumption. And how much is 350 million acres compared to what we got? It's 78% of what we have. And it's not feasible, because we have to grow food, to devote 78% of our cropland to producing grain-based ethanol. So this doesn't work. It's not scalable. It's not feasible, grain-based. There's 5 million acres in Oregon, 1/90th of the U.S. total. So you can divide everything by 90 to figure out how much growing corn in Oregon and Willamette Valley can help with local fuel distribution. The answer is very little from grain-based ethanol. And that's just a graph which you don't need to pay any attention to other than the fact that our cropland is actually being reduced in the United States, but our yield's going up because of improved efficiency. Thus, we can sacrifice cropland for strip malls, which basically is what we're doing. All right. So grain-based ethanol does not scale. So why don't we use the whole crop? Whether that's agricultural plant waste, or whether you grow a particular crop called switchgrass, go ahead. That's what switchgrass looks like in Holland. Way in the back, that white thing's a big wind turbine, by the way, and over there on the left is some transmission line infrastructure, so it's the right stuff is in this slide. And that's a farmer processing switchgrass. Very dense. Lots of blades per unit square foot. It grows to about a height of about 3 feet. So there's a lot of mass per square foot in this switchgrass, a lot of it. So the question is, can we grow this stuff and stick it in our cars? And does that represent a reasonable alternative fuel solution to using gasoline? So let's have a goal. I mean, we're familiar with this. Somebody said we should get to the moon in 10 years. We did this. Okay, it's possible to have goals and carry them out. So you need to have goals. So here's a goal. Let's produce 100 billion gallons by the year 2050. Why not? It's just a bunch of words. And the question is, can we get there? Can you construct a pathway that gets you there? So currently, switchgrass, you can grow about 5 dry tons of it per unit acre. But if you apply the same breeding practices that we have in corn, you can improve that by a factor of 3 to get 15 dry tons per acre over the course of the next 10 years. If you can do that, you now need 88 million acres to produce 100 billion gallons. Now we have 450. 88 out of 450 is about 20%. That's not outrageous, especially given the following statistic. Right now, we use almost that much cropland to begin with just to grow soybeans on for animal feed, and animals would be even fatter if they ate switchgrass than if they ate soybeans, because switchgrass has significantly more protein per unit acre. So you've got a win-win situation. A farmer can grow switchgrass to put in your car, and to put in what you eat. So that's good economics there. So what are the requirements to reach this goal? Well, the first is we have to invest about $1 billion annually in research and testing so that you can get up to these 15 tons per unit acre. Now, we invest $1 billion a day in gasoline, so $1 billion annually in this enterprise seems cheap. The current investment in all this, by the way, is about $50 million a year. $1 billion a year is not very much. You can scale that in any way you want. It's just not very much. So this is easily doable to make that investment. If you do this, you can calculate that the cost of production for a gallon of ethanol-based fuel from switchgrass by the year 2015 is going to be about 60 to 90 cents a gallon. The current price of gasoline that you pay, $1.30 of that comes from the processing of crude oil. So it's likely that this kind of production scheme would lead to lower prices for the consumer, although I'm sure that would be taxed so that the price of gas remains constant. Now, the other thing that's required is that no one in their right mind thinks that driving around in 20 mile an hour per gallon average fuel economy is a sensible thing to do for the next 40 years. And even the industry doesn't believe that anymore. And there's all kinds of new concept cars that are going to be coming out. And Japan and Europe will lead the way, and we'll play catch-up, of course, just like we did 25 years ago, in the late 70s. Same problem. So let's imagine that we can actually get the average fuel economy of 50 miles per gallon. There's nothing technologically, there's no hurdles to do that. So if you can do that, get to 50 miles per gallon by the year 2030, and if we devote 10%, just 10% of the available cropland in the United States for cellulosic ethanol production, you can achieve 50% penetration in the fuel market. 50%, half of all the gas used will now come from switchgrass in your 50 mile per gallon vehicle. That's a gigantic penetration. That's scalable. That's a solution. That's not, you know, a 1% solution. This is a 50% solution. And that's just with 10%. If you want a 100% solution, you have 20% cropland. This is feasible, but only if we declare this as our long-term plan. We start investing in this now, and we don't have someone in Congress standing up in the year 2011 saying, let's get off the switchgrass trajectory and invest in something else. Had we done that, we would have never gotten to the moon. Getting to the moon was an object lesson in leadership and investment and in sticking to the plan. If we don't have that political will or leadership anymore, and it's debatable whether we do have that on any level, federal, state, local, period, we can't do anything. All we can do is run around in a semi-chaotic state trying to figure out what to do. You need to have a long-term plan, you need to invest in it, you need to see it through, and you need to think about it up front and make a choice. And finally, the one thing that's politically favorable toward this particular pathway is that it creates lots and lots of jobs. Imagine an infrastructure required to transport and distribute large amounts of crop waste. That's a huge employment item. And the other advantage this has is that we have an infrastructure right now that pipes liquids all around our country. That makes it a problem for hydrogen, because hydrogen is initially going to be a gas, and turning it into a liquid requires an energy cost. And so ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, has the added advantage is that it's a liquid, and we already have the infrastructure. You don't have to change the infrastructure. You create jobs, use the same infrastructure, get 50% market penetration by only using 10% of cropland. That seems like a pretty physically sensible solution to our current $200 billion a year or $1 billion a day habit on using crude oil. Thank you.
So we'll take our usual 5-minute break and develop some questions around the tables, and then we'll hear from Bill Tracy, our first questioner.
You are listening to the City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLBR Bend 88.1, KLFO 88.1 Florence, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR 89.1 Reedsport, and KMPQ Roseburg 88.1 FM.
All right, and now here's City Club member Bill Tracy with our first question.
I'm Bill Tracy, a City Club member since 2001. I think as the discussions at most of the tables have shown, it's hard to come up with a question that our speaker hasn't already covered in his very effective presentation. So I'm going to toss out the three pre-prepared questions that I had and ask two others. I think it's great that the question of America's future energy supply is finally getting the attention of the public, the media, and researchers, but the government seems to be lagging. So my first question is, do you have any suggestions on how we as individuals can encourage our governments to pay more attention to this important issue? And the second question is, as well as being a source of energy, this is going to be a little tricky because I'm changing the subject on him. As well as being sources of energy, our finite supplies of ancient stored carbon also serve as raw materials for asphalt, petrochemicals, plastics, movie film, textiles, pesticides, pharmaceuticals, even cosmetics. Could you add to what you've told us about alternative energy sources by talking about alternative sources for petroleum and coal as a vital raw material that we depend on for plastics, polyester fibers, and fertilizers, for example?
Governments always lag these days. This is one of the reasons why, you know, this whole concept of going to the moon can't work anymore, because we have an overly bureaucratic, overly disconnected government. So even trying to implement a plan, you know, first you got to develop a plan. That's a challenge there. But then you have to implement. And implementing plans are becoming very, very hard these days because of the lack of understanding that this is a national need. There's been a lot of testimony, I gave some about 5 years ago, to Congress citing the energy crisis as a national priority, a threat to our national security. There is a very large document, mostly classified, that the Pentagon has produced declaring this as a national security problem and suggesting everything that I've talked about today as one potential solution. But none of this is registered, this concept that energy is a national problem that needs to be solved on the 20-year timescale. And it's probably because the 20-year timescale is too many political lifetimes long, so nobody cares. So that's what needs to change. Registration, this is a national problem. As far as the second question goes, in about 10 years, it's going to be a brand new world in the sense that designer molecules are going to be quite amazing. You're going to go to Circuit City and buy your designer molecule computer, believe it or not. It's not going to be very big. It's going to be real powerful, and it's going to count little individual electrons as bits rather than streams of them as voltage. It's a whole new trillion-dollar economy at stake in terms of designer molecules. That will help with the synthetic problem, but also the alternative uses of petroleum that were mentioned, that's such a small amount compared to the worldwide consumption that's closer to a trillion gallons of gasoline a year. So any reduction that you make in the use of petroleums for individual vehicle transport in the world extends the pharmaceutical lifetime of petroleum products in a life. So I don't really think that's a worry. Unless we can't solve the fuel problem, then it just goes away fast.
Jansen, member since 2002. Our question has to do with the sustainability of some sort of plant or something for a biofuel. At what point does the ground that it's in right. just become sterile or fertile or infertile to even produce anything?
The big revolution in this 50% efficiency has been largely in solving that problem. In the past, you know, an acre would go fallow after about 30 years of work on that. Now with better means of nutrient replenishment, although this is tangled up with long-term drought, particularly in the western United States in terms of global climate change, and that's really exacerbating this nutrient loss problem because, the ground's drying up and its nutrients are blowing away. So It's unclear in terms of switchgrass, if you have an acre of land, can you get 15 tons per dry tons per acre for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years? That's unclear. The goal is to have a nutrient replenishment system so you can get it for at least 10 to 20 years. And that would give you some window of opportunity to start thinking about doing other things like how can we leverage toward a hydrogen economy. So ultimately on, say, I'd say at a 40 to 60 year time scale, the switchgrass is not sustainable beyond that for the reasons you mentioned.
My name's Maddie Fry and I'm a visitor. Our question is, where would the grass be grown and how much water does it need to grow?
Doesn't need that much water, not any more than it doesn't tax the current irrigation system at all. And this would be grown mostly in the Midwest, Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska. Very little would probably be actually produced on the West Coast. You grow it where most of the available cropland is, and that's still in those states.
Arnold Ismack, City Club member since 1998. Our table was impressed by the wonderful benefits that you described for ethanol production and use, but wonders about the negative side of it. For example, if we convert from food corn production to ethanol production, what's that going to do to the cost of food, cost of corn? And also, as other countries like in South America chop down their forests to plant corn, what's that going to do to the environment overall?
Well, there's many ways to answer that question. 6.2 billion people on the planet and growing is an environmental impact, regardless of what you do. It's just a question of how fast you make your impact on. As far as the price of groceries related to your fuel source, at the moment, by far, the bigger lever arm is on the potential large increase in price due to a rapid scarcity in this 84 million barrel a day problem, translating into $5, $6, $7, $8 a gallon. Price of gas in Europe at the moment is about $8.50 a gallon. That has much larger potential for escalated prices throughout our society. As I said, 2015 production cost of ethanol is 60 to 90 cents a gallon. So in principle, ethanol-based fuel should be relatively low priced to the consumer. The reason that, again, this is all possible is because of increasing crops per unit acre, and that also solves the food problem to some extent. So I don't really think you sacrifice 10 to 20% of your land to grow fuel on. I don't think you're going to sacrifice sufficiently large percentage of your food production to drive prices higher than it would be if you relied on gasoline to transport those crops. South America can grow sugarcane quite a bit. The Brazilian economy can become 100% ethanol based on extant sugarcane crop. No need to cut down anything else. Sugarcane is a very high yield, high energy density yield crop. Currently in the United States, we can only grow it in Hawaii, of course. So I think South America has a lot going for it in terms of native sugar canes. I'm not too worried that deforestation is going to be motivated by the need for ethanol. It'll be motivated by other things, but that won't be one of them.
Peggy Robinson, City Club member. Okay, if the cellulosic process of switchgrass or whatever plant is successful, and we solve the problem of replacing gasoline with it, that won't help at all with the problem of global warming, because it will be burned and add CO2 to the atmosphere. And maybe it would be better for us in the long run if we didn't solve the problem and were forced to drive less.
Well, of course. If everybody drove less, if fuel economy went up, you would slow down the rate of carbon production. It may be too late for that. That's another talk, though. The lever arm, everyone should be aware of a term, BRIC, B-R-I-C. Stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. It was invented by Goldman Sachs in the year 2003 to represent a new economic phenomenon. That economic phenomenon is that 2 billion new capitalists exist on the planet now that didn't exist 5 years ago. 2 billion. This is an enormous impact on the world economy, enormous. The rate of growth of these economies is incredible. It actually completely dwarfs whatever the U.S. is going to do in the next 10 or 20 years. Ethanol production will produce far less carbon per unit molecule of the material than gasoline. But what your question really brings up is, what do you want to wait the most for our future? What's more important? Mitigating global climate change, in which case we should be investing in implementing CO2 sequestration right now. It's possible to do technically, it's just very expensive. And what we really should be doing is converting toward a hydrogen economy. If our number one goal is to stabilize CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, it's a hydrogen pathway that goes. But the hydrogen pathway is considerably more expensive. And so ultimately you got to compromise. And you know, 6.2 billion people on the planet involves compromising and figuring out the least worst alternative. Because you don't have a choice. That's how you have to think.
Janet Calvert. You were talking about improved agricultural methods to get the needed yield for the switchgrass. Do those practices include genetic engineered crops and heavy use of fertilizers? And then kind of a follow-up, would switchgrass require the same kind of subsidy that corn production does from the government?
Ultimately, yeah, this requires a subsidy to get to the high yield. But as I said, that subsidy is sort of like $1 billion a year, so it's not very much. What was the first part of your question? Sorry.
Would the improved practices include
genetic crop production could be very much part of this. I mean, you might want to figure out, well, what can I make in my lab that can optimize, you know, what I can grow on the land? And so these designer crops, just like we have designer short-term trees for producing paper now, I think very much are part of this. And that's part of what the R&D investment is determining feasibility designer crops. In terms of fertilizer, they don't require any increase in the current use of fertilizer. By the way, fertilizer is the best example of the influence of humans on the planet, disrupting the material cycle. We mine the atmosphere of nitrogen at a rapid rate. We dump it on the ground for fertilizer. All that runs off into estuaries, which robs estuaries of oxygen and kills all the shellfish. So if you want to think about humans as perturbing the system, the best example is we are the agents that transport nitrogen directly from the atmosphere right into the ocean. That's what we do.
John DeLow, City Club member. How much does the increasing in farming yield use the oil? And it's how does that work?
Well, the agriculture industry is heavily petroleum-based, but the total amount of petroleum used by the agricultural industry is negligible compared to what we're putting in our cars. So that doesn't matter.
Tim Keeley, City Club member. Pardon me if some of this is a bit redundant. Is switchgrass native to the USA? Does it take much bad fertilizer to produce? And what, if any, negative impacts does moving to this mass production of switchgrass have on humans and animals?
Well, I think that's a good question because, you know, one doesn't really know, well, what if we turn 80 million acres into switchgrass? You really don't know until you do it how effective you are on a per unit acre basis. So I think that's a legitimate worry. And the way you deal with this is you start to phase it in and say, well, let's do a 5 million acre project and see what it looks like. How much fertilizer does it require? How close are our real yields to our desired yields and stuff like that? And that's where this $1 billion comes into play to do those kinds of experiments. So that would be the right way to do it. You just suddenly don't want to say, well, this is the year we're going to turn 80 million acres into switchgrass. I mean, you have to phase this in. But the point is we're not doing any of it at the moment.
Charlie Quinn, if cellulosic ethanol is able to be produced from switchgrass, are there other feedstocks that we could use from the existing waste stream or forest products that could be used as well?
Sure. I mean, that's what the agreement with Chevron and Weyerhaeuser is to use forest products. Switchgrass just happens to have the highest energy density per gram of material of available waste. But you can get lower energy densities and lower yields per gram by using other things. So, yeah, forest products, waste wood, waste chips, whatever, are very viable to process and turn into fuel.
I always like the word conservation. So lowering the speed limit would conserve a great deal of oil. Is there any possibility? I know as soon as the present administration took over, they upped the speed limit to 70. How much would that save if we lowered it like other countries do in Europe? They lower it to 50 in the summer. when most of the traffic occurs. Also, plastics, how much do we use in the way of oil for manufacturing plastic?
Well, overall plastic use is about 5% of total oil use worldwide. And a lot of plastics can be replaced by synthetic material, so I don't think that's much of a lever arm. Yeah, you can lower the speed limit, but people are impatient. It's a big country, so it's never going to happen. But what could happen, which would be far more beneficial, is that you should be driving a car that gets 40 or 50 miles per gallon, not one that gets 20 miles per gallon. And that's the only solution that there is available in terms of conservation. That's an enormous effect. It's simply double the fuel economy. All of a sudden, you've gone from 200 billion gallons a year to 100 billion gallons a year. You can't get bigger effects than that. So that's what needs to happen. And I think the auto industry recognizes that, as I was telling my table. I mean, Ford doesn't want to go out of business, although they're trying to. They don't want to. So 100 years from now, they still want to sell a product. And if that product's an individual transportation pod running on hydrogen that weighs 500 pounds, that's what they sell, and that's what you buy. And they're still in business.
Nancy Oftero, City Club member. We live in a town, a small town, really, but we recycle. We have some of the greatest bike paths in the world. We're aware of conservation. We've recently been named number one in cities of our size as far as conservation of energy. What can we as individuals in a small town do to help this situation?
Well, that's pretty simple. You can do three things. You can get rid of every incandescent bulb in your house. That has a big effect. You can buy $100 worth of weather stripping and apply it in the appropriate windows and doors. That has a big effect. And you can drive 25% less miles than you used to. And that has a big effect. And all those things are easy to do. And when you get, 200,000 citizens doing them, it all adds up.
Alan Zelenka, City Club member since 1991. You presented us a problem and a solution that requires a paradigm shift.
Uh-oh.
And the problem with paradigm shifts is that those that have a vested financial interest in the status quo need to be able to see how they can make profit and make the paradigm, new paradigm, be in their best interest financially. So have you seen, and can you give us examples of where the oil companies and car companies have actually started to make that shift?
Yeah, I can, but let me first answer that question from a basic cultural point of view. Because I actually teach a class on this at the university occasionally, or I get away with teaching it, let's put it that way. We make ourselves things culturally very hard on ourselves because we don't value proactivity. We value reactivity. That's what we do. You get rewarded for being reactive. In other words, suppose that you're, a computer geek in a company, right? And, every day you have to solve somebody's problem because they broke the printer and they blew up their computer or they don't know how to attach it to a network. And you're viewed as the most valuable player in the organization. You're the problem-solving guy. You get a raise. Everybody knows who you are. And no one can live without you. Now, suppose you're that same guy and you've cleverly anticipated all these problems and you fixed them in advance by being proactive. You don't have a job anymore. Nobody knows what you do. There's no value in that. And so the way we manage businesses or the way we manage the planet is we react to issues. So we are very poorly prepared to deal with the concept of a paradigm shift, and if we can't get better at that, then we deserve what we get. So that's the broad answer to that question. The more specific answer is that you see some examples of this in the auto industry at the moment. The minivan concept, which was all the rage for about 20 years, is going away for the crossover, whatever that is, vehicle concept. You're getting different vehicle types being made, more interest in hybrids because the American consumer is showing an interest in buying a hybrid thing, for instance, so you're responding to your market. Shell has a very long-term plan to be called Shell Hydrogen sometime by the end of this century. They're doing a lot of research, particularly in Europe, about how they can turn their company from one that processes crude oil into one that processes their company into hydrogen. A lot of this is happening behind the scenes. It doesn't make the headlines. But the bottom line is that, in the end, most people running companies aren't completely stupid, and they do understand that their product line eventually has to change when their feedstock starts to go away. And most companies are making long-term plans for this. And I think you're starting to see the immediate consequence of this as more and more hybrid vehicles penetrate the market. And the first plug-in hybrids will be out probably this fall. Plug-in hybrid means that you can stick it in your wall outlet and recharge it. Now, of course, there's a large energy system analysis to do with that. I mean, if you're getting your electricity from a coal-fired steam plant, it doesn't help that you have a plug-in hybrid vehicle. If you're getting electricity from a wind farm or from a hydroelectric facility, it does help that you've plugged in your car. So people in the Pacific Northwest ought to buy a plug-in hybrid Toyota Camry when it comes out next fall. Not that I have stock in Toyota, but you'll see then Ford and GM or somebody else start to introduce over time, near term, these alternative kinds of vehicles because public's consciousness is beginning to become aware, and that's a market to tap into. Does this line ever end?
No.
keep going back and sitting down?
This is just the beginning. Julie Daniels, City Club member. So you have provided a solution to a problem, but it seems that the solution that you've provided very much is based on the fact that the problem stays the same. And one of the problems that we have is that we move goods and services around the planet in an incredibly inefficient way. For example, the transportation of our food, thousands and thousands of miles. What future do you see in decentralization and changing behavior with regard to how we consume goods and services so that the problem changes?
Well, problems seldom change, so it's a decent physical assumption to assume the problem's going to remain the same. But the goods and services issue is central to this. We transport all goods and services in the United States. 78% of it is transmitted, 78% via trucks. High energy costs per kilogram of material. We have blown the opportunity for light rail infrastructure throughout the American West. That was something that should have been done post-World War II. So the cost of retrofitting that is astronomical. A sensible solution is the following. One of the limitations of using hydrogen as a fuel at the moment is onboard storage. But that's not a limitation for trucks at all. Trucks could be retrofitted with hydrogen capabilities quite easily. And so a really sensible solution to this goods and services problem, since we're going to remain with trucks and the associated billions of dollars a year to repair freeway damage by too many trucks going per unit length, per unit time, per freeway, and that's a constant now, is to convert the trucking fleet into hydrogen on some time scale, say next 20 to 25 years. And worry about the ethanol channel for small vehicles. And that could really work. I mean, that's a real solution. And that gets out of this problem that the price that you pay for strawberries at the store depends on the price of gas.
I'm Darnell Mandelblatt, City Club member. I spent last week in central Pennsylvania, where they grow a lot of corn. And my taxi driver, who is a farmer, told me that he thinks corn fuel is not transportable because it's a green fuel and it degrades. Is that true in any way?
No, it doesn't degrade. I mean, if you let it sit on the ground and rot for few months, you'll lose the energy content, but it doesn't degrade if you can process it within a month, basically. But the generic problem of transporting wet biomass is a big one because it's very heavy, and that's what creates all these jobs. So, yeah, transportation requires a real infrastructure if we're really going to generate tens of billions of gallons with this.
John Brumbaugh, City Club member. Ask a question every week. Last night, Charlie Rose interviewed Arnold Schwarzenegger, talking about the problems down in California. And he got into the use of electric cars, so you sort of talked about that a moment ago. I heard a decade or two ago that if we got into good photovoltaic systems, that the land area, like 100 square miles in northern Arizona, not that it all has to be there and there's no power lines there, could generate more than enough electricity to take care of the entire United States at maybe its present situation. But I mean, if we would really get into that, wouldn't we have that? The sun is a really important source that should be looked at, and it also creates no kind of pollution afterwards?
The right scale is the following. The sun doesn't shine all day long, so you use electricity all day long, so you have to have an energy storage system. It requires material and land use. If you want 100% electricity from solar photovoltaic cells, you need an area which is 60% the area of Nevada by our current consumption. If it really was 10,000 square miles in northern Arizona, we would have done this. So the scale is too large for photovoltaic technology to do this. But you could have a sensible number of, well, let's have 20% of all electricity come from solar photovoltaics. And actually, again, if you look at it from the systems point of view, the right thing to do is to convert northern Africa into a giant PV farm and make hydrogen there. Because that will give you the most amount of energy that you can get. So there is this problem of grid connectivity, which is extremely expensive.
Yep. Hi, I'm Zach Vishnoff, new City Club member. I've got a question about political sustainability.
Just is that an oxymoron?
Well, kind of. OSU recently had a project, I think it's called the Bent Grass, with Monsanto, and those field trials led to what's being called a superweed. There was many articles in the Oregonian about it. So I'm wondering if this $1 billion subsidy is gonna be aiming at field trials, that the field trials are already a little bit in trouble. And then the second part is I'm wondering if the $1 billion might be better guided towards subsidizing teleconferencing abilities for our elected officials. People like Al Gore wouldn't have to fly around the world warning everybody if we had a more secure infrastructure of teleconferencing abilities.
Actually, believe it or not, that teleconferencing idea is a really legitimate one. And the problem is that we don't know how to reproduce. People don't pay any attention in a teleconference at all. There's virtually no communication, learning, absorption of information whatsoever. No, it's true. And it's too bad. And once we get more fully of immersive technology, I mean, the question is, you really want to be able to reproduce this setting and whatever spontaneity there is right now without having had to move. There should have been no energy cost associated with you receiving this information. That's the philosophy here. There shouldn't be any energy cost with that at all. I should, you know. But we don't have the technological gadgets and tools yet to form the proper immersive pay attention to atmosphere. But it's something that I think will happen, and I think there really is something to this idea that, I mean, I complain about this every time I have to go to D.C. to do a National Science Foundation review or a NASA review, and that, you know, why are you moving my mass? All we're doing here is sitting in front of computers anyway. It's just information processing. Why do we have to move all this mass to D.C. so we can sit in a room for 36 hours a day and decide what 100 billion mission to cancel? I mean, you know, there's got to be a better way. So I really do think that there's going to be an energy savings that's going to come through basically information decision-making done electronically. I think that's definitely going to happen. In terms of where to invest the R&D, well, you invest the R&D in crop breeding techniques and in field trials. And if the field trials go bad, you have a data point. That's what, you know, science is. Science produces mostly, you know, failed experiments. If it doesn't do that, it's not science. And then you have to learn from that and go on. So there's nothing wrong with investing $1 billion a year and failing. I mean, that's a fine outcome.
Hi, Bill Rogers, a member since 2006. With the exception of a question asked a couple times ago, you've given only passing mention to other potential alternative energy sources. So with the exception of solar that you just talked about, could you say something about other sources, such sure. as wind and yeah. tidal and so on, and why you didn't give more attention to those?
Well, I'll tell you three things. Number one is that I believe wind energy is the most scalable solution by far, and the reason is very simple. 15 years ago, you took a 100 by 100 square foot, 100 foot by 100 foot plot on the land, stuck a turbine on it, and you got 500 kilowatts out of that. Today, you take that exact same footprint, and you get 5 megawatts out of that. That's an unbelievable economy of scale. Per unit land, you have increased the yield by a factor of 100. This is why wind can be sold to the consumer at 1 to 2 cents a kilowatt hour. It would be easy to get 50% total electrical energy generation by Great Plains wind farms by the year 2025. And offshore wind has incredible potential too, but it's more expensive due to grid connection issues, so make hydrogen there. So wind, I think, is your future. It's going to happen. It's already happening. It's happening all over Europe, and in the U.S. is starting to catch up. The problem with tides is the tidal flow only happens about 6 hours out of every 24 hours, so it's a low duty cycle. The real solution to this, however, worldwide, is the oceans have been collecting solar radiation for 4.5 billion years. There's enough energy in the heat differential in the ocean to power the planet for 200 years easily. So ocean thermoelectric conversion is another large-scale solution.
Everyone, I just wanted to ask you, have you ever heard so much information so tightly packed? Wasn't that terrific? And we want to award Greg our glasses as a thank you for adding vision to our community. And I just wanted to show you how it works. You take it over to Pine Mountain and you kind of go up like that.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Before you go, we have a few announcements. First of all, City Club members are invited to enjoy a complimentary free week's membership to the DAC. I don't know whether you know that or not. You can sign up at the welcome desk or see Jim Wilcox, the director of membership. And tonight is the second in our at-large events related to the planning for the Franklin Corridor. There's an event at the depot from 5 to 7:30 nights, wine and snacks and cheese and things to do, kind of catch up on that first phase of the project. And then tomorrow from 9:30 to 5 o'clock is the second forum, sort of designing the Franklin Corridor. Next Friday, our forum at 11:50 will be on anti-Semitism with the Community Alliance of Lane County. And then on the 27th, the last meeting of the month, we're going to have a meeting. Our program is on taxation and representation, and the speakers will be Faye Stewart and Pete Sorensen, our county commissioners. Be sure to check out further our website at www.cityclubofeugene.org for program details and so on, and we would invite you to seriously consider, if you are not a member, joining the City Club of Eugene. If it's Friday at noon, it must be the CCE at the DAC. Thank you very much.